Today is Monday, May 31st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Ethiopian pro-government demonstrators denounced the United States for imposing restrictions on aid over the Tigray conflict.
A week ago, the U.S. imposed sanctions on economic and security assistance to Ethiopia over the conflict. Washington also said it would bar current or former Ethiopian or Eritrean officials it deems responsible for the crisis.
Plus, a possible unity government in Israel could end 2 years of electoral limbo. We'll have these stories and more next. In Ethiopia, pro-government demonstrators denounced the United States on Sunday for imposing restrictions on aid over the Tigray conflict. The protest took place at a massive rally organized by the authorities to show support for their positions. Reuters' Maha Albadrawi starts us off.
More than 10,000 people attended the rally. They carried banners written in English, Arabic, and Amharic, with slogans like USA, show us your neutrality, and Ethiopia doesn't need a caretaker. The demonstration was larger than typical pro-government rallies, and public criticism of the US is rare. A week ago, the U.S. imposed sanctions on economic and security assistance to Ethiopia over the conflict. Washington also said it would bar current or former Ethiopian or Eritrean officials it deems responsible for the crisis. Ethiopia is facing increasing international pressure over the conflict in Tigray, where it and neighboring Eritrea sent troops last year to oust regional authorities.
Maha Albadrawi of Reuters. Atrocities, including brutal gang rapes, extrajudicial killings, and forced evictions, have been part of the violence in Tigray. Those reports are coming from victims, witnesses, local authorities, and aid groups. Thousands of people are estimated to have died, and more than 2 million people have been displaced by the conflict. The Ethiopian government called the U.S. actions misguided and regrettable. The United Nations Refugee Agency voiced deep concern on Friday at reports of soldiers taking hundreds of people away from displacement camps in the Tigray region, saying such sites should be a safe haven. Three aid workers and a doctor told Reuters last week that Eritrean and Ethiopian soldiers forcibly detained more than 500 young men and women from four camps for displaced people in the town of Shire in the northern region on Monday night. A spokesperson said that some of the people had been released after the UNHCR raised the matter with Ethiopian authorities, but gave no figures. The International Criminal Court's prosecutor has urged Sudan's transitional government to hand over suspects wanted for war crimes and genocide in the Darfur conflict. ICC prosecutor Fatou Bensouda arrived in Sudan's western Darfur region on Saturday to meet with authorities and affected communities in the region. Among those wanted by the International Criminal Court is former Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir, who has been in jail in Khartoum since his ouster in April of 2019. Sudan's transitional government has previously said that war crime suspects, including al-Bashir, would be tried before the ICC, but that the trial venue is a matter for negotiations with the Hague-based court. The chief editor of a popular internet news site in one of Belarus's largest cities has been detained on suspicion of extremism. The Sunday arrest of Horodna.life editor Alexei Shoda comes amid a crackdown on independent journalists and opponents of authoritarian President Alexander Lukashenko. City police said the website, quote, posted information products that were duly recognized as extremist, end quote, but did not give any details. Shoda has collaborated with the country's most popular internet portal, Tutbi, which authorities closed this month after arresting 15 employees. Israel was gripped by political drama Sunday over the possibly imminent end of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's record run as the country's leader. Reuters' Emily Wither has the details.
The reign of Israel's so-called King Bibi could soon come to an end. Benjamin Netanyahu's record run as the country's longest-serving prime minister hangs in the balance as Israel was gripped by political drama over the weekend. After four inconclusive parliamentary elections in 2 years, a 28-day mandate for opposition leader Yair Lapid to form a new government runs out on Wednesday. Media reports say he is close to putting together a coalition that would end Netanyahu's 12-year stretch. Far-right politician Naftali Bennett is the kingmaker, whose Yamina party has six key seats in parliament. Netanyahu's opponents have described the pairing as a government of change, compromising factions from the left, centre and right. Such a diverse grouping could be fragile and would require the support of Arab members of parliament, whose political views differ sharply from Bennett's Yamina party. Netanyahu on Friday fueled speculation about the end of his tenure in a Twitter video. "Real alert," he wrote, and warned of a dangerous left-wing administration on the horizon. Bennett reversed course over ousting Netanyahu before fighting erupted in Gaza between Israel and militants.
Emily Wither reports for Reuters News. Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan said on Sunday that bilateral ties with India cannot return to normal until neighboring India restores the semi-autonomous status of the disputed Kashmir region. Islamabad downgraded its traditionally acrimonious ties with New Delhi in August of 2019 when Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government revoked the special status of the India-ruled part of the majority Muslim Himalayan region and declared it as an integral part of India. Khan acknowledged that the restoration of trade links with India would immensely benefit Pakistan's economy. The White House and Senate Republicans are still several hundred million dollars apart on a deal to improve U.S. roads, bridges, and other projects. This report is produced by Reuters' Zachary Goldman.
Negotiations between U.S. Democratic President Joe Biden and Republican senators over an infrastructure package are inching forward, even though disagreements remain. Republican Senator Shelley Moore Capito told Fox News Sunday, quote, "I think we can get to real compromise, absolutely, because we're both still in the game." Capito leads a group of six Republicans who have been in regular contact with the White House. Her side last week proposed $928 billion to improve roads, bridges, and other traditional infrastructure projects. Much of the funding would come from reallocating money meant for other programs. The Biden administration's latest offer in negotiations is for $1.7 trillion and would include projects such as home care for the elderly. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg described negotiations to ABC's This Week, saying, quote, "There's movement in the right direction, but a lot of concerns." One of the many sticking points, the White House wants to offset the cost of the plan with new taxes on the wealthy and on corporations. When asked about rolling back some of the tax cuts enacted during the Trump administration, Capito said, quote, "I'm not going to vote to overturn those." She also held the line against funding for projects that go beyond physical infrastructure. The talks were expected to continue this week, even though Congress is on a break, with the Senate returning on June 7th.
That was Reuters reporter Zachary Goldman. Early Sunday morning, a shooting outside a banquet hall in Florida where a concert was taking place left two people dead and more than 20 others wounded. The AP's Julie Walker reports.
It happened in northwest Miami-Dade at El Mula. Police Director Freddie Ramirez says an SUV pulled up outside. Three people got out with assault rifles and handguns as the rap concert was ending
and began shooting indiscriminately into the crowd.
He says it was not random.
This type of gun violence has to stop. Every weekend it's the same thing. This is targeted. This is definitely not random.
Ramirez also tells WPLG-TV this is the start of what police are expecting to be a violent summer.
It's very disheartening, but it's a trend that you're seeing around the country.
TV personality Marcus Lemonis tweeted a $100,000 reward to capture the suspects. I'm Julie Walker.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. The World Health Organization is asking for 20 million doses of COVID-19 vaccines for African countries to administer second doses to those who have received their first shot. Lisa Schlein has the details.
After 3 weeks of declining rates of COVID-19 infections in Africa, the World Health Organization is reporting an increase in cases. It says its latest figures of more than 4.7 million cases, including 128,000 deaths, indicate a 17% rise over the previous week. WHO Regional Director for Africa, Machidiso Moeti, says she is concerned, but that it is too soon to tell whether Africa is on the cusp of a third wave.
While it's too soon to say if Africa is seeing a resurgence, however, we're seeing increases in a number of countries, we are monitoring the situation very closely. And we see that we are balancing on a knife edge. So this makes the rapid rollout of COVID-19 vaccines all the more important.
Moeti says South Africa accounts for nearly one third of the 65,000 new cases reported by WHO. She says she fears new variants of the virus circulating in South Africa may be spreading into neighboring countries. She notes Namibia and Zambia are among 11 African countries experiencing more cases. So far, 28 million COVID-19 doses of different vaccines have been administered in Africa, a continent of 1.4 billion people. Moeti says Africa needs at least 20 million second doses of the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine by mid-July to give everyone who has received the first dose full immunity.
Africa needs vaccines now. Any pause in our vaccination campaigns will lead to lost lives and lost hope. Another 200 million doses are needed so that the continent can vaccinate 10% of its population by September this year.
Moeti appeals to countries that have vaccinated their high-risk groups to share their excess doses with Africa. She notes France is the first country to donate tens of thousands of doses to Africa from its domestic supply. WHO says the European Union has pledged more than 100 million doses for low-income countries, and the United States has promised to share 80 million doses with lower income countries. Other wealthy countries have said they will follow suit. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Saudi Arabia is requiring all pilgrims for the scaled back annual Hajj in July to be vaccinated against COVID-19. In Tanzania, where vaccinations have still not begun, Muslims hoping to go to Mecca are urging authorities to start inoculations. Charles Combi is up next.
Omari Abubakari, like many other Muslims in Tanzania, wants to make the pilgrimage to the holy city of Mecca. It's an integral part of the Muslim faith, but for now, only those immunized against COVID-19 can take part in this year's Hajj. Abubakari is worried because vaccinations in Tanzania have yet to be approved.
The time remaining is limited, but still, we haven't given up. We expect our top leaders to check on the issue of vaccination carefully so as we can accomplish this holy worship. We failed to go last year because of this disaster, and if it continues till next year, it means our worship has ended. To us, this is the main pillar of our religion.
Until earlier this year, Tanzanian authorities had rejected COVID-19 vaccines. Then President John Magufuli instead promoted false remedies for the disease. Soon after Magufuli's death in March, his successor, Samia Hassan, formed a COVID-19 task force to advise her government on handling the infections. In their report 2 weeks ago, the committee declared the vaccines to be effective and recommended that travelers going abroad be among those to get their shots first.
The committee advises the government using its institutions, continues and moves to allow free vaccines, using vaccine brands listed by the World Health Organization, because the shots are effective and safe since they are scientifically proved.
Last week, President Hassan said the government is checking to see if COVID-19 vaccines that are available in other countries can be ordered for Tanzanians. But with no vaccination campaign in sight, Muslim leaders see the chances of Tanzanians attending this year's pilgrimage to be low at best.
I cannot say that we can't accomplish Hajj worship, but the percentages seem to be very low to accomplish the worship this year. The remaining percentages only Allah will decide, because even if we get vaccinated, as our leaders are struggling to accomplish, still, time is a challenge.
Meanwhile, COVID-19 has not stopped Tanzanians like Abubakari from continuing to worship in mosques. But for now, his plan to join his fellow Muslims in Mecca for Hajj prayers remains up in the air. Charles Kombe for VOA News in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
Record numbers of COVID-19 vaccinations have been completed in Australia as a snap 7-day lockdown continues in the nation's second most populous state. 7 million people in Victoria are subject to strict stay-at-home orders after a growing cluster of infections was recently detected. Australia has managed to mostly contain the coronavirus through lockdowns, the closure of its international borders, and strict quarantine measures for returning citizens. But the national vaccination program has been beset by supply issues and hesitancy among many Australians. Phil Mercer takes it from here.
There are estimated to be 100 active coronavirus cases in Australia, according to the health department. About half are in Victoria, which is under a 7-day lockdown. It's the state's fourth shutdown since the pandemic began. The number of infections in Australia is small compared to other countries, including Japan, Brazil, and the United States. However, community transmission of the virus has been rare in recent months, and the outbreak in Victoria is significant. There's been complacency in the community and mounting hesitancy about vaccines and possible side effects, which have delayed the national inoculation plan. Health authorities in Victoria, though, have said the lockdown has sent residents flocking to injection centres across the country in record numbers. However, some experts believe that it might be too late to prevent another wave of infections in Australia's second most populous state. Dr. Michelle Ananda-Raja is an infectious diseases expert at Melbourne's Alfred Hospital.
We've been here before. I think, though, that the stakes are higher this time because we have all the factors for what is essentially a perfect storm. We have a largely unvaccinated population. We have winter approaching and we have an unforgiving variant on the loose at the moment. You know, Victoria is primed at the moment for a third wave, and we need to do everything possible to prevent that from happening.
Melbourne, the Victoria state capital, endured Australia's longest COVID-19 lockdown last year. Once again, the nation's second biggest city finds itself under tight restrictions. Masks are now mandatory. Places of worship and schools are closed. Victorians can only leave home for essential work, shopping, exercise, caregiving, or to get a coronavirus vaccine. Businesses are facing heavy losses. A man infected with a highly contagious COVID-19 variant, who stayed at a quarantine hotel for returning travellers, is thought to be the source of the outbreak. Australia has recorded just over 30,000 coronavirus cases and 910 deaths since the pandemic began, according to government statistics. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Mass testing for COVID-19 and vaccinations continued in Vietnam Sunday after authorities announced that they have discovered a new coronavirus variant that appears to be a hybrid of strains first found in India and Britain. Health authorities said that the variant spreads quickly by air. After successfully containing the virus for most of last year, Vietnam is grappling with a rise in infections since late April that accounts for more than half of its nearly 6,900 cases. So far, there have been 47 deaths.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists David Stevenson and Edwin Salpeter are credited with being the first in the 1970s to theorize that raindrops of helium fall within the interiors of Jupiter and Saturn. Other scientists throughout the years have published studies to support those theories. A team of French and U.S. scientists recently conducted experiments that also support the theory of helium rain inside the two gas giants. The scientists are said to have reached their findings by recreating the interiors of the planets in laboratory settings. They detail their findings in a new study that has been published in the journal Nature. The study provides evidence that it is possible for helium rain to fall, considering the predicted span of pressure and temperature environments of Jupiter and Saturn. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Much of the eastern United States is buzzing. The sound of periodical cicadas is becoming pervasive with the emergence of the Brood 10, or Great Eastern Brood, which emerges every 17 years. VOA's Steve Herman in Alexandria, Virginia, has been listening to the big red-eyed insects, which come above ground after the soil temperatures rises above 18 degrees centigrade, ending their long slumber.
They're here and much of everywhere across a 15-state region in the United States. After spending nearly their entire 17-year lives underground, sipping sap from tree roots, trillions of nymphs are emerging to mate and then die. The male cicadas are making all the racket, a mating call produced by vibrating membranes in their abdomens. Their collective symphony approaches a level of 100 decibels, as loud as a motorcycle. The insects do not sting or bite, but many Americans consider them a noisy annoyance they will have to endure for several weeks. Steve Herman, VOA News, Alexandria, Virginia.
Oklahoma's second largest city of Tulsa marked the 100th anniversary of the 1921 massacre of the black community. The remembrance comes as many continue to fight for justice and reparations for victims. Reuters' Freddie Joyner has more.
The city of Tulsa, Oklahoma, has marked the 100th anniversary of the 1921 massacre, when a white mob killed and burned its way through the city's Greenwood District, which was, at the time, one of the largest and wealthiest black communities in the United States. Tulsa native Duke Durant.
Booker T. Washington walked here. He came here and named it the Negro Wall Street, right? It's like, man, it's like a Negro Wall Street. That's the significance of it. This is the Mecca.
According to a Human Rights Watch report in May, around 300 people died in the massacre, and more than 6,000 survivors were sent to internment camps, which is why many, including Reverend Robert Turner, are calling for reparations.
As Joshua walked across the walls of Jericho.
For nearly 3 years, the pastor of historic Vernon African Methodist Episcopal Church has been leading weekly marches on City Hall.
This bipartisan, very much so moderate, really right of center commission said we need A, reparations to the survivors, B, in the absence of the survivors, reparations of payments given to the descendants, C, scholarships for the descendants' children to go to college for free. And number four is an economic incubator for the businesses of Greenwood, the historically black business, to return. And the fifth one, a memorial to house the bodies that were dumped in mass graves, a memorial to inter those bodies. Not a one of those recommendations has been done. And I add a sixth one, which is criminal investigation into the race massacre of 1921.
The call for justice is now growing beyond Tulsa. Turner is also an advocate for H.R. 40, a bill to fund the study of slavery and discrimination in the colonies and the United States from 1619 to the present, and recommend appropriate remedies. It has been floated in Congress for more than 30 years, but never taken up for a full vote. Just a week ago, survivors of the Tulsa massacre, like 107-year-old Viola Fletcher, spoke in front of Congress asking for justice.
I have lived through the massacre every day. Our country may forget this history, but I cannot. I will not. And other survivors do not. And our descendants do not.
Freddie Joyner from Reuters. This past weekend, singer B.J. Thomas died of lung cancer at his home in Arlington, Texas. And actor Gavin McLeod died at his home in Palm Desert, California. Thomas was 78 and McLeod 90. AP Entertainment correspondent Margie Zaraletta has this look back at their careers. Raindrops
are falling on my... Billy Joe Thomas changed his name to BJ as a kid because too many of his Little League teammates were named Billy Joe. Thomas made a name for himself with songs like Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head, Hooked on a Feeling, New Looks from an Old Lover, and this one. Hey, won't you play? Thomas also sang the theme to the TV show Growing Pains. He said in a 1997 AP interview he was painfully shy when he was young.
You know, and I was that way the first, you know, gosh, 10 years of my career. You could hardly get me to say 8 words a week, you know.
McCloud was an unknown actor for more than a decade before he got the part as TV writer Murray Slaughter on The Mary Tyler Moore Show. He originally went for the part of Lou Grant, but realized he was wrong for the part. McCloud had also auditioned for Archie Bunker in All in the Family, but realized he was wrong for that, too. McCloud's other major role was Captain Steubing on The Love Boat. He became so known for that role that he titled his autobiography, This Is Your Captain Speaking. I'm Archie Zaralletta.
The last Monday in May, which is today, May 31st, Americans honor members of the armed forces who lost their lives in service to the country. Originally named Decoration Day in 1868, the Memorial Day holiday does not recognize a specific battle or war, but the sacrifices of all the men and women who sacrificed their lives for the country. In remarks at an annual Memorial Day service at Veterans Memorial Park, U.S. President Joe Biden says it's always important to honor those that made the ultimate sacrifice.
We must remember the price that was paid for our liberties. We must remember the debt we owe those who have paid it. The families left behind.
Jackie Wright recently spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips ahead of the holiday about her father, Wally, a Vietnam veteran. Wright began the conversation by sharing a story about her father and then Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara.
McNamara was in Vietnam and he was touring the troops. And my father was chosen as one of the honor guards in a helicopter that was escorting the Secretary of Defense at the time. It was one of several helicopters. My father's helicopter happened to crash in the Mekong River at the time, which took the life of a 32-year-old father of four and husband of 15 years, and also took the life of a young man, almost 21 years old, that month he died in March 9th, 1964, and that was PFC John Francis Shea. My father was a Southerner from Jacksonville, Florida, and his comrade who died in that helicopter crash on March 9, 1964, was an Irish Catholic young man from Willimantic, Connecticut.
Now, their destinies were tied later, weren't they, after they came back to the States to be buried? Your father ended up in a segregated cemetery, right?
It was really interesting over the years to find out many years later, because I didn't know at the time growing up, that the 114th Aviation Company was actually named after my father's Lieutenant Shannon. The Shannon Wright compound was the 114th Aviation Company camp at Vinh Long, Vietnam. The widow of Lieutenant Shannon, Ginger Shannon Young, she was so gracious to come to a ceremony in honor of my father after my siblings and I decided to have my father exhumed and reburied at Arlington National Cemetery. In the process of finding out about having my father reburied at Arlington National Cemetery, we also found out that we could have our mother reburied with our father. And so she died 6 years after our father on the same day, March 9th, 1970. There was a young man from Houston by the name of George Mole, who was 19 at the time that our father died. And he came to the ceremony also, finding out 2 weeks before the ceremony in 2014 that we were reburying our father. George Mole, along with his wife, Diana, came. And it was just such a wonderful, special time, because we actually talked to someone who had worked with our father in Vietnam. And he was a gunner at the time. And he basically said that our father was like a mentor to him. And for that to be a young white man from Houston, Texas, and my father was an older black man in his 30s from Jacksonville, Florida, and for them to make such a bond, it was just very special to us.
That was Jackie Wright speaking about her father, Wally Wright, to VOA's Adam Phillips. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. And on behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.